You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Manuel toku ingoa, no mai hari mai, ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Emmanuel, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Theo. If I akane, coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the National Infrastructure Plan and the Employment Relations Amendment Bill. I then spoke to Oratayao coordinator Marnie Prickett about the government's plans to merge several key ministries in a move that has raised their alarm. Theo, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Greenpeace's executive director, Russell Norman, on the government's decision to pursue the construction of a liquefied natural gas terminal in Taranaki.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahai ana koto te whakarongo ki enei korero anō. Hei pakehiri rukiruki maronga I te pai. Tukituki I irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM I te kati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
To hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
With the long-delayed opening of the City Rail Link due to open later this year, and the government relaunching their Roads of National Significance policies, eyes have turned to a perennial problem. Why do we spend more than any other OECD nation on infrastructure, yet receive far less bang for buck? To answer these questions, the government asked the Infrastructure Commission to write a plan that could be the basis for a bipartisan infrastructure pipeline, the National Infrastructure Plan, to give us steady development and perspective on our infrastructure needs and issues. And this week, the Employment Relations Amendment Bill under ACT MP Brooke Van Velden has reached its final reading before being put into law. It is set to overhaul our employment system. Supporters say it will make it easier for contractors to get the arrangements that they want and will increase work. Critics say it will push workers into more precarious positions with less protections from exploitation. For this week's catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the National Infrastructure Plan and the Employment Relations Amendment Bill. Kia ora, Ricardo.
Morena, thank you for having me.
I want to start us off today by talking about the National Infrastructure Plan. There's been a long discussion about the problems that New Zealand has had in infrastructure, and these have only been made worse with the recent floodings. How do you feel about this current plan? Is it enough?
Ironically, there's a lot we actually agree with the plan, and a lot of this talks about how government debt, which works very different from household debt, could be used to invest in actual useful things like modern infrastructure, as opposed to, for example, tax cuts that mostly benefit wealthier people, so that we can invest in things like interregional rail that gives us a more resilient transport network and a more resilient economy, so that we can invest on adequate public housing, so that we can invest in a state-planned manufacturing industry. And so we agree with a lot of the stuff in the report. Ironically, the government is doing the opposite of what the report says, which is to invest in things like the LNG plant that will cost $1 billion and will not particularly be useful for the economy compared to other types of investment.
Another thing I've seen some people criticize the government for in relation to not sticking to a plan like this is the Roads of National Significance. Do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, look, yes, absolutely, and that these are massively expensive roading projects that a lot of the business cases don't really add up with the political rhetoric that we're hearing from politicians. This is why we've long called for better investment in things like inter-regional rail and intercity rail so that we can have a proper rail passenger network like other modern cities are doing and already have. These kind of investments not only are more fiscally sustainable in the long term, they actually better help reduce congestion, and they also better support the transport of goods, which can better boost our economic productivity.
Is that something you hold true for all of these projects, or are there some roading projects that you think might be acceptable?
I think the large majority of projects the government hasn't made a particularly good case with. And what I am particularly concerned about is the government's playing with things like public-private partnerships for infrastructure projects, which historically in New Zealand have resulted in huge cost blowouts. And we end up also devolving our infrastructure, effectively like the maintenance of it, et cetera, and the running of operations to private companies as well, which is problematic.
Speaking of how we run this infrastructure and how we manage it, as you said, there's a huge bill associated with this infrastructure plan. It's not really a plan in the sense that it's laid out. It's more that it's estimated to be within the $100 to $200 billion range. How might New Zealand pay for this?
Well, one of the things that we've got to acknowledge is that the government has often talked about government debt as if it was like your credit card debt, and that's not how government debt functions. Compared to our GDP, our debt, and compared to other developed countries, it's actually still relatively low in relationship to our size of the economy, et cetera, as a proportion of our economy. And what this tells us and what experts have been telling us is that there's still plenty of room to better invest in more productive infrastructure that actually allows us to have a more productive economy, which in turn allows us to pay that debt faster. And a lot of that will also, for us, be about making sure that we overhaul the tax system so that everyday people pay less and the wealthy few who are making huge bucks at a time of a cost of living crisis pay their adequate share of tax.
Now, a big reason that people have pointed to the need for a plan like this is that New Zealand spends more on infrastructure per capita than other countries whilst also receiving less. Now, a large component of that is that we're in an isolated part of the world, we can't draw on other people's industries as easily, and we're a small population with a large landmass. But are there other reasons, perhaps, that it might also cost a lot of money to build here?
A large part of that is also the types of infrastructure projects we choose to build. The roading, the huge roading projects that do not necessarily result in lower traffic is a great example of that. I mean, look, just take the lead off a lot of American cities that just told us time and time again that all we need is one more lane. They've spent billions and billions on building these lanes, and then they're still congested and people are spending more time in traffic getting to work and to school. This is why we need to invest in more productive infrastructure. And I go back to the issue around rail. I think that's a really good example. The other thing is that also our government has decimated our manufacturing industries, and we're basically deindustrializing. I think there's a huge potential for the state to take a more active role in planning the economy and, for example, making sure that we can manufacture raw wood products that we end up exporting to basically get processed overseas to then import them back for things like building housing or other infrastructure projects. And so investing in our manufacturing industry so that we can actually have a more productive economy will make the building of infrastructure also cheaper.
All right, I want to move on now to talking about the Employment Relations Amendment Bill that has been debated for a final time. For our listeners that do not know much about the bill, could you give us your understanding of it?
Yeah, so it's a terrible bill that basically in large parts copy-pasted the talking points of Uber, a massive multinational many people will be familiar about that takes its profits offshore and do not treat its users particularly well, as has been documented by the Uber drivers themselves. And the bill effectively creates a new class of contractor. And once you're classified as that type of contractor, you're not adequately protected by minimum entitlements like sick leave, like minimum wage, holidays, etc. And it makes it almost impossible for you to challenge that status in the courts, like the Uber drivers tried to do and won. Other things that the bill does is that it effectively also does not allow people to be automatically covered by what we call a collective agreement. That is something that union members bargain for and win, that secures better wages, better health and safety conditions, better security of hours. Anyone who's worked in retail and hospo will be familiar with some of that those precarious conditions when it comes to security of hours or, for example, low wages. And this bill has been touted as making it easier to hire people, but we know that's not true. All it will do is actually reduce wages. It will reduce working rights for everyday people. And it, for example, in the case of Uber, it will continue allowing Uber to make huge bucks, paying no tax and treating the drivers in a really poorly way, as they have documented in the court, where they are exposed to really unsafe conditions and do not have any adequate entitlements when they're sick that allows them to live well.
Could you go over with us the ways that it undermines the union membership?
Well, the fact that, for example, people are not covered by a collective agreement when they start their work does not allow people to see the benefits of being part of a union. Collective agreements are won by union members and organizers to secure literally better wages, often better working conditions, security of hours, greater health and safety in your workplace, which is really important if you're working, say, for example, in areas like construction or security. Being automatically included in the collective agreement for those 30 days allows you to see the benefits of that work that was secured by everyday workers. Without that, it effectively also creates a lesser incentive and the conditions for people to join their union and be part of it, but also to see the benefits of being part of a union. All this does is to gut the working conditions of everyday people in the sake of the gig economy, which the government promised us is going to be amazing for everyday people, but we're seeing more and more that many corporations are using the so-called gig economy to lower working conditions for everyday people, and Uber is a prime example of that.
How would people be classified into this new tier of contractor? Is this something that would be happening from the outset in the contract you organize with your employer, or is it something more about the type of work you're doing?
Well, the part of the problem is that normally you would think that whether you're a contractor or an employee would be about the type of work that you do and how you do that work. But now it's basically being shifted to the type of agreement your employer basically offers you. And once you sign it up, it makes it, like, they've changed basically the law to make it effectively impossible to challenge that. Not everybody will necessarily immediately transition to that, but what we'll likely see is employers that are not trying to act in good faith, trying to now shift into turning more of their workers into these contractors, effectively, and this type of contractors, that will then mean they won't have to offer them the same type of security that they would have done if they had been an employee.
And I'm going to have to leave you soon, but just before we do, there's been news on New Zealand First potentially proposing a referendum on the Māori electorates this electoral cycle. Can I just get your first and final thoughts on it?
Well, the Green Party has a bill to entrench the Māori seats, because this is a small way in which we could actually honour Te Tiriti. But more than anything, it speaks of New Zealand First's complete focus on attacking Māori, attacking migrants, and doing actually nothing to address the cost of living crisis, doing nothing to actually support lowering house prices and rents. They would rather introduce a bill that makes English the official language and to try and fight in a referendum of Māori seats than on actually improving wages for everyday people. This shows that they're on the side of the wealthy few that would rather keep us distracted and fighting each other as opposed to actually improving material conditions for everyday workers, which is what the Greens will be fighting for this election.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March on the National Infrastructure Plan released by the Infrastructure Commission as part of their push to create a steady pipeline of works, and the Employment Relations Amendment Bill, changing the landscape of our employment.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Now, last hour, someone requested this song by the Cults, so doesn't look like it's been played. Maybe it has, maybe it hasn't, but we'll be right back after this break. Keep it on the beat.
Hey. For my next move, I activate my Blue Eyes White Dragon.
You'd think that would scare me, but I'm taking off my mask and pulling out my face card.
Wait, is it my turn? I don't know the rules of this game, but I have a B card.
We're doomed!
The most powerful card in the deck, the B card, provides you with the ultimate power, the ability to win tickets, albums, and more. Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month.
Get out your speediest eyewear. The B-Rave is back, and faster than ever before. B-Rave, Friday, March 6th at the Mothership.
Stepping up to the booth for your entertainment is a host of iconic 95BFM DJs, including Co-Governance,
Rosetta from Breakfast, Nicholas from Drive,
Stinky Jim, Naru, back-to-back babyface killer, Porcelain, back-to-back pros.
Race you there. 95BFM, Spates, Kira Huketsu, and Under the Radar present B-Rave at the Mothership. Friday, March 6th. Tickets available now at Under the Radar.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A three-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Hey, Captain, do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months. Since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that. I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim. Is that my name? Captain.
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim.
I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim. Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity, and soul to your Friday afternoons. It's time to move. Time to get loose. Anywhere you are. Land of the Good Groove. 1 till 2 p.m. every Friday, right here on 95BFM.
Before the break, we had Half Hexagon with By the Farm, and before that, Colts with You Know What I Mean. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
Ah!
The Wire.
Last week, the government officially announced plans to build a liquefied natural gas, or LNG, terminal in Taranaki, with the goal of finishing construction by next year or early 2028. The terminal is intended to provide a stopgap for New Zealand's energy network during dry years, where hydro sources may not generate sufficient energy to support the network. Coming at a cost of over $1 billion, a new levy on electricity users of $2 to $4 per megawatt hour will be introduced to help fund the terminal. However, the project has already faced criticism from groups such as Greenpeace, who pointed to the poor economic viability of the terminal and its further investment in fossil fuels during the climate crisis. To understand more, I spoke to Greenpeace's chief executive, Russell Norman, on the ramifications of this plan and possible alternatives for mitigating dry year risk. So starting off, did the decision by the government to pursue a liquefied natural gas import terminal come as a surprise?
Well, not really, in the sense that they had previously flagged it. And obviously the government's already got a track record of subsidising fossil fuels and climate destruction. So in that sense, no. But in another sense, I mean, it's kind of crazy, right? We're in the middle of a climate emergency after all the extreme weather events New Zealand's had. And the New Zealand government is choosing to tax people more to subsidise more climate pollution. I mean, it's completely bonkers. So in that sense, I guess it is surprising.
Right, and one of the big arguments that the government is trying to push to justify this decision is that it will come as a way to kind of shore up against dry years, against renewables like hydro and wind power. Is this a valid concern or a risk?
There's been a lot of work done over the last, decade really, about how to deal with the dry year risk, and there's many solutions that have been put on the table. Everyone looked at the LNG import facility solution and said it's not much of a solution because it doesn't really address the dry year risk because it doesn't produce enough energy. It's the most expensive option. And of course, the greenhouse gas emissions are really high and it sends the country's energy system in the wrong direction. Very few people supported the idea of an LNG import facility. I mean, the gas industry did, obviously. And the fossil fuel lobby, Energy Resources, Aotearoa, they supported it. But pretty much every energy expert thought it was a pretty stupid idea.
Right. So, I mean, to what extent does this decision indicate some kind of, like, path dependence by the government? I mean, we've seen them reopen gas and oil exploration, even though we haven't had any kind of fines over the last 20 years. Genesis has stopped accepting piped connections to gas, and the Frontier report last year said that creating a liquefied natural gas terminal for dry years didn't really make any economic sense. So what is the real justification here?
I think you've got a government which is deeply committed to fossil fuels and trying to maintain New Zealand's dependence on them. Right from the moment they got in, they abolished the government investment in decarbonising industry, which was a big fund which was designed to reduce dependence on gas in particular, but fossil fuels more generally, and was already making good progress. They got rid of the New Zealand Battery Project, which was looking at how we could deal with the dry year risk through a hydro pump storage scheme. And so at each step along the way, they've removed the policies that would facilitate the transition away from fossil gas and then looked at ways that they might maintain the dependence on fossil gas. So that was the $200 million of yours and my money that they want to give to oil companies for oil exploration, oil and gas exploration. And now the billion or $2.7 billion all up they're going to take from us to build this ridiculous LNG import facility. So they have a very 1950s fossil fuel dependence kind of mindset. It's basically the policies are identical to Trump's. And so in that sense, that's the kind of government they are, and they're going to keep pursuing these policies. But from the point of view of the New Zealand energy system, I think they're going to slow things down and make it worse, and we're going to burn billions of dollars. We're going to waste money, but it's going to be hard to stop the transition. So they're trying to stop it, but already a lot of the businesses that are highly dependent on cheap gas have closed, and whatever they do isn't going to change that. A lot of businesses are transitioning off gas. Gas is going to get more and more expensive over time. So this transition has begun. Obviously, the government's trying to slow it down with all the taxpayer subsidies, but it's pretty much unstoppable. And really, we need to, embrace this transition away from fossil fuels rather than fight it tooth and nail.
Yeah, and kind of going along with that, I mean, what's the opportunity cost here when we consider how, you know, since this terminal will cost $1 billion of capital, and they're looking to impose a $2 to $4 levy on each megawatt hour that people use, what's the opportunity cost here when that kind of funding could be redistributed to renewables?
Yeah, I mean, imagine if the government had announced instead that they were going to invest in more renewables and storage for the New Zealand energy system, it would make a dramatic difference. So, yeah, I mean, not to mention the $200 million they're spending on oil and gas exploration, which is no doubt going to come up with nothing. So, yeah, I mean, there's a big opportunity cost. All that money we could be using to transition our energy system away from fossil fuels. I mean, the great thing about New Zealand energy system is that, you know, aside from oil, we have an opportunity, like we've produced a lot of our own domestic energy and gas is coming to an end. We can electrify the transport system as well as, you know, invest in cycleways, walking, cycling and public transport. And we reduce the cost of imported energy dramatically because we spend so much money importing energy for transport, for the transport system. So, you know, we have this great pathway in front of us and the government's just slowing it down and making it hard. I don't think, in spite of Luxon and Shane Jones and Winston Peters and David Seymour, in spite of all their efforts, I don't think they're going to stop this transition, but they are going to cost us billions of dollars in wasted investments on the way, and they're going to slow us right down.
So what kind of investments would make a better, for example, shoring up against dry years? You mentioned battery kind of networks. What would that look like, and how would that improve our electricity dependence going away or transitioning from fossil fuels?
So if you think about it at kind of three levels. Like, one level is the kind of whole electrification of everything that's going on, which will just continue to happen, right? And that's things like household heating, for instance, space heating in households. It's things like electric cars, which has just begun, but it's going to keep happening because they're just in the long term much cheaper. So you go, okay, this is great, because if we've got renewable energy generation that sits behind it, then that's a good thing. And then the second issue is, okay, you've got to build more renewable generation. So that's more solar, it's more wind, it's more geothermal. And we've got some really good offshore wind opportunities in Taranaki as well, now that we've beaten the seabed mining proposal down there. But the thing about all of those is you have to balance the short-term variability. And so that means you need more storage in the system as well. Lots of places have put a lot of storage now in, and that's both like household batteries, it's utility-scale batteries, large batteries into the network. And they're really working well now to get through your evening peak load. So in a country like New Zealand, we have winter evening peak loads when people come home. And so we need the storage in the system from the solar during the day and the wind and the geothermal to get us through the evening peak loads. And then New Zealand, because it's an isolated electricity grid, it has a third problem, which is relatively unique, which is hydro is a significant part of the system right now, about half of all generation. Occasionally we have dry winters, and so there's not enough water in the dam. So how do we get ourselves through that situation? Because if you electrify everything, and we're all dependent on all this great electricity from renewable sources, and then you have a shortage of electricity, it is a significant problem. And so that's why the previous government was exploring the battery project. Greenpeace was on the panel for that. Basically your options there is you've got big pump hydro, so you could go for a big centralised scheme. So there were some options looked at down there in terms of a big centralised hydro scheme, which would provide a huge battery, much bigger than any lithium-ion battery on the planet, like 1,000 times more energy. Or you can overbuild renewables, so you put in more renewables than you generally need so that you can cope with the dry year. Or you put in multiple bits of storage around the place, so you don't necessarily go for one big centralised option. The other part of it is demand-side management. So, like, if you can reduce your demand during dry year periods, then that can help us a lot as well. And we've already done quite a bit of that with the aluminium smelter down in Bluff. So there's a bunch of pieces to the puzzle. The lithium-ion batteries that people put in their houses, and it's going to become more and more common, they're fine for the kind of 24 to 48 kind of hour cycle of meeting shortages in generation. But they don't deal with like a three-month dry year period. And that's why an isolated electricity system like New Zealand needs a significant kind of either storage or demand-side management or overbuilding new renewable generation to deal with the dry year risk that happens every now and again.
That was Greenpeace's chief executive, Russell Norman, on the climate and economic costs of the liquefied natural gas terminal and alternative approaches to mitigating dry year risk in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
This is Simple Song by The Shins. We'll be right back after this break. Keep it on the B.
Kept under my vest.
will be a simple song to say what you've done. I told you about all those fears and the way they did run. You sure must be strong. And you feel like an ocean being warmed by the sun.
Biting my clothes to keep from screaming, taking pills to keep from dreaming. I want to break something important. I want to kick my dad in the shins. I was referring to the present and past tense. It was the only way that I could survive it. Close my head in the car door. I want to sing this song like I'm dying.
I need something soon, I need something soon, I can't.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was Something Soon by Car Seat Headrest, and before that, Simple Song by The Shins. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
To little fanfare, the government announced a huge overhaul of key ministries, merging the Ministry for the Environment, Ministry of Transport, Ministry of Housing and Urban Development, and the local government functions of the Department of Internal Affairs into one new agency. Coming on the back of yet more fast-track approval reforms, which have cut out community voices like Forest and Bird and led to criticisms of environmental destruction, the move is a huge overhaul in governance, leaving many critics alarmed that this is yet another move pulling the country away from climate mitigation and adaptation. To understand why the government's plans to merge these key ministries is alarming them, I spoke to Ora Taiao coordinator Marnie Prickett.
For our listeners, could you give us a bit of an overview of Ora Taiao and what their mission, what their kaupapa is?
Yeah, Ora Taiao is an organisation that is a members organisation which is made up of people who work in health. So they are healthcare workers that are doctors and nurses and other sorts of health services, and also health researchers or people who work in health policy, so people who cover health generally, and who are concerned about climate change as one of our biggest, one of the biggest threats that we have to our health.
And recently you've been voicing your concerns about the merger of some ministries. Could you talk more about that with us?
Sure. So the government's proposing to merge the ministries for the environment, Ministry of Transport, and Ministry for Housing and Development. And all three of those ministries are critical climate adaptation and mitigation ministries. They've got serious and important roles to play in our national response to climate change. And this government has shown over the past 2 years that it either doesn't understand the seriousness of climate change, or it's choosing to deny its seriousness. We've seen it weaken almost all of our climate change policy in one way or another. Examples are reducing the agricultural emissions target, opening up for oil and gas exploration again, along with many other things. So that does not inspire confidence when we're thinking about a major merger of ministries that have critical climate change roles.
Could you talk to us about those climate change roles that these ministries play? Maybe give us an overview on the most important roles.
Yeah, sure. So they obviously, these ministries have multiple sort of functions. But if you think about, let's take Ministry for the Environment, for example, the health of our environment is critical in our adaptation and mitigation of climate change. Ecosystem health underpins our stability, and if we degrade our natural environment, we increase the risks to human health from climate change. So the Ministry for the Environment oversees environmental regulation, and so it's got a critical role in mitigation, mitigation of climate change is reducing emissions. So that comes through kind of land use, it comes through other types of sequestration, potentially native forest sequestration, preferably. And it also comes through adaptation. So things like, people might have heard the term nature-based solutions, so implementing ways of reducing the impact of things like flooding and other sort of storm events by using the strength of the natural environment to reduce those effects and adapt to a new and less stable climate. So that's just one example. That's the Ministry for the Environment. That's got a strong role in climate change. But then think about transport, think about housing and urban development. Those are really critical as well in terms of reducing emissions. Transport is one of our major sources of greenhouse gas emissions, and also housing and development is really key to how we, you know, are we developing in the right places? Are we putting housing in the right places? Are we creating low emissions development? So these are, these have a sort of range, a suite of roles which can really make or break our response to climate change.
If this were being done by a different government with perhaps a better track record on climate change, a merger like this might be seen as optimistic reform to create a real climate change ministry, one that's going to take charge of adaptation and mitigation and minimizing emissions. Do you feel that a big part of the concern here is that the government has lost the trust of at least your organization on climate change, and that this falls into a pattern of eroding climate policy?
It does fall into a pattern of eroding climate policy, and I suspect that the government has lost the trust of many people on climate change, especially as we have seen this year. You know, many communities across the country have been experiencing those frequent and more intense storm events and having to deal with the consequences of that. So the fact that there's been a couple of, you know, 2 years in power of weakening climate policy, but also this merger is now being made on the backdrop of what is really sort of chaotic change within the government, trying to change the Resource Management Act, so to replace our Resource Management Act, which is our overarching and sort of primary act that we use to protect the environment and also have sustainable development. That was the idea of the Resource Management Act. And now we have these two bills that the government wants to replace it with, which don't account for climate change. It's extraordinary to be in 2026 and to have a government that's put forward major environmental and planning policy which doesn't even account for climate change, which will have an enormous effect on anything that those bills want to do. So, yes, it doesn't inspire confidence. If anything, it sparks huge concern. It rings alarm bells for us because there's this rapid fire change coming from the government that doesn't account for climate change, even though it is arguably the biggest challenge that we face. And it has huge implications for our health and our well-being and the stability of our communities in Aotearoa.
If the government were to realise that lost trust on climate change and start to try to change face and win back that trust, what would you want the first and primary move to be?
I think that the National Party has to stand up and be clear about what their position is. It's got two small parties involved in the coalition that are openly celebrating an increase in emissions. We had the ACT Party leader give his State of the Nation speech over the weekend and openly celebrate more agricultural emissions allowed and the return of oil and gas exploration. We've got the New Zealand First Party with its kind of bluster about mining and drill, baby, drill. You know, those parties, you know, the National Party really needs to be clear. Are those parties, are they representing the National Party's view, or are they expressing a minority view? And at the moment, with the actions that the government has taken over the last 2 years, they appear to be expressing the whole government's view. So if the National Party wants to restore confidence, it needs to bring into line its minority parties, and it needs to be really clear that climate change is a big issue for New Zealand, and it needs to make it a centrepiece to its election campaigning.
Is there anything you want to say before we end the interview?
Yeah, the thing that I'd like to say is that, you know, climate change, I think, often sounds like it's something abstract. It sounds like something that is sort of big and complicated, and it's hard to get on. But what we mean by that is we mean how, you know, how resilient is your community to flooding, for example? Are our communities built in the right place? Do we have access to clean and safe drinking water that isn't going to be washed out with the next flood? Can we afford to repair our houses again and again with climate events? You know, these are the real questions that we have to face, and they're not abstract questions. They're questions that are really important for people's everyday lives and their health. So, yeah, that's the last thing that I wanted to add.
Well, Marnie Prickett, thank you very, very much.
Excellent. Thank you.
That was Orotayao coordinator Marnie Prickett about the government's plans to merge several key ministries.
Ooh!
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this song. Keep it on the B.
Why?
That was Andy's Big Bender by DJ Name. Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki mātou mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Chief Executive for Greenpeace, Dr. Russell Norman, and Ora Tai Ao Coordinator, Marnie Prickett. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4.
That was The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.